tell you who I am. My name is Maria Hamlin Zuniga. I was born in the United States in Minnesota, and I've lived the last 25 years of my life in Central America, mostly in Nicaragua, but also working in Guatemala and in Salvador. Well, today's session, we're going to look at the quincentenary, but from a different point of view, perhaps. First of all, I would like to put something here on the board. If you've seen this before, don't be the first to answer. I want to write a word, and after I write that word, I want you to remember the first thought that comes into your minds, okay? Just the first thought. Keep it frozen there. Okay? Who wants to tell me what you thought of when you saw this word?
Freedom.
That's what I said.
Freedom. Another word?
Large.
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 Discovery.
There are more of you out there, let's hear.
I've been affected, I don't think you want my word.
You what?
I've been affected, I don't think you want my
word. Oh, but I do want your word. I want the first word.
It's about racist.
Okay.
How about if we had a more than one word thought?
That's all right. Give me two, or three, or sentence, or whatever.
The first thing that came to my mind, and conditioned by knowing the title, I'm sure, of this talk, was we had no right to name it. Already had a name.
It had a name. Good.
That's mine was Turtle Island.
It had a name.
What's a name? Turtle Island. That's right.
What I asked was, what's the first word that comes to your mind?
I have to admit, it was home. I've been in France for a while.
Okay, now did everybody respond? No.
My first word, well, I've got a couple.
Okay.
One is reservation, and the other one is melting pot.
Okay, melting pot and reservation. Did you?
I had freedom.
You had freedom. We had three freedoms here.
This generation.
Did you give me your word? What do you think of when you see that? You've been in my sessions before. Have you done
isn't
this before?
Strange,
three. You tell me what do you think of when you see this word?
Mountains.
She's still good.
Diversity?
Diversity.
Did everybody respond?
What was the last one?
Diversity.
Diversity. Okay, thank you.
That's very interesting.
Very interesting. Okay.
It's very interesting.
No one thought USA.
I beg your pardon?
Anyone thought United States?
Well, yes, that's what's interesting to me, because the first week, the first words were like U.S., us, and home, no? And this group has, for some reason, maybe it has to do with generations, I don't know, has more... more thoughts that come out of this first, as a first response. When I came to the United States on this trip from Nicaragua to come up to the U.S., to come here to Holden, I bought a special ticket. And my ticket is Discover America. And I think that this sort of says what a lot of people think about America. I live in Central America, and I was coming to the U.S., and the flight was United Airlines, and they were saying, Discover America. And for a lot of people, America is the United States. But America isn't the United States. The United States is a part of North America, together with Canada and Mexico. There's Central America, there's South America. And all the people who live on these lands are Americans. And all of them have names for this land. Before Columbus or anybody else who was white stepped upon this land. And I think that's really important. And most of the people's names for their tribes mean the people, don't they? Have you found that in working with Native Americans, American Indians, U.S. or elsewhere? All people have somewhere in their name the people of this land. So what I wanted to do today was to take a look at, read and reflect upon some of those first voices before the cacophony, is that the word in English? That came upon us, upon this land. So I need about 6 volunteers. They're just very short testimonies. Why don't you come up here? Don't be afraid. Bring your chair. Okay. Hi. I don't know your name. I'm Lydia.
David.
Okay. I need 6 people. No, you don't need a chair. You just need your bodies. Okay, now, these are really nice stories. I think you'll enjoy them. What I want you to do is listen carefully. Remember that these stories were handed down to us through oral tradition, and sometimes we have, because we read or watch television, we've forgotten how to listen and imagine. But try to do that right now as we look at each one of these stories.
The creation. The woman and the man dreamed that God was dreaming about them. God was singing and clacking his maracas as he dreamed his dream in a cloud of tobacco smoke, feeling happy but shaken by doubt and mystery. The Lakota Indians know that if God dreams about eating, he gives fertility and food. If God dreams about life, he is born and gives birth. In their dream about God's dream, the woman and the man were inside a great shining egg, singing and dancing and kicking up a fuss because they were crazy to be born. In God's dream, happiness was stronger than doubt and mystery. So dreaming, God created them with a song. I break this egg and the woman is born and the man is born, and together they will live and die. But they will be born again. They will be born and die again and be born again. They will never stop being born because death is a lie.
The stars. By playing the flute, love is declared, or the return of the hunters announced. With the strains of the flute, the Waiwai Indians summoned their guests. For the Tucanos, the flute weeps. For the Kalinas, it talks, because it's the trumpet that shouts. On the banks of the Negro River, the flute confirms the power of men. Flutes are sacred and hidden, and any woman who approaches deserves death. In very remote times, When the women had the sacred flutes, the men toted firewood and water and prepared the cassava bread. As the men tell it, the sun got indignant at the sight of women running the world, so he dropped into the forest and fertilized a virgin by slipping fig juice leaf juices between her legs. Thus was born Jerubbaal. Jerubbaal stole the sacred flutes and gave them to the men. He taught the men to hide them and defend them and to celebrate ritual feasts without women. He also told them the secrets they were to transmit to their male children. When Jerubbaal's mother found where the sacred flutes were hidden, she condemned him to death. And with the bits that remained of him, she made the stars of the sky.
White were once the feathers of birds, and white the skin of animals. Blue now are those that bathe in the lake into which no river emptied and from which no one was born. Red those that dipped in the lake blood shed by a child of the Kindu tribes. Earth color those that rolled in the mud, and ashen those that sought warmth in its extinguished campfires. Green those that rubbed their bodies in foliage. White were those that stayed still.
Love. In the Amazonian jungle, the first woman and the first man looked at each other with curiosity. It was odd what they had between their legs. "Did they cut yours off?" asked the man. "No," she said, "I've always been like that." He examined her close up. He scratched his head. "There was an open wound there," he said. "Better not eat any cassava or bananas or any fruit that splits when it ripens. I'll cure you. Get in the hammock and rest." She obeyed. Patiently, she swallowed herb teas and let him rub on pomades and unguents. She had to grit her teeth to keep from laughing when he said to her, "Don't worry." She enjoyed the game, although she was beginning to tire of fasting in the hammock. The memory of fruit made her mouth water. One evening, the man came running through the glade. He jumped with excitement and cried, "I found it!" He had just seen the male monkey curing the female monkey in the arm of a tree. "That's how it's done," said the man, approaching the woman. When the long embrace ended, a dense aroma of flowers and fruit filled the air. From the bodies lying together came unheard of vapors and glowings, and it was all so beautiful that the sons and the gods died of embarrassment.
The gods made the first Maya quiches out of clay. Few survived. They were soft, lacking strength. They fell apart before they could walk. Then the gods tried wood. The wooden dolls talked and walked but were dry. They had no blood nor substance, no memory and no purpose. They didn't know how to talk to the gods or couldn't think of anything to say to them. Then the gods made mothers and fathers out of corn. They molded their flesh with yellow corn and white corn. The women and men of corn saw as much as the gods. Their glance ranged over the whole world. The gods breathed on them and left their eyes forever clouded because they didn't want people to see over the horizon.
Authority. In remote times, women sat in the bow of a canoe and men in the stern. It was the women who hunted and fished. They left the villages and returned when they could or wanted. The men built the huts, prepared the meals, kept the fires burning against the cold, minded the children, and tanned skins for clothes. Such was life for the Ona and the Yagan Indians in Tierra del Fuego until one day the men killed all the women and put on the masks that the women had invented to scare them. Only newly born girls were spared extermination. While they grew up, the murderers kept repeating to them that serving men was their destiny. They believed it. Their daughters believed it, too. likewise the daughters of their daughters.
Okay. Now we're going to go into little groups. Five people maybe in a group, okay? And we're going to discuss two things. What do these stories, these voices from pre-Columbian times, tell us about these Americans? And the second question is, what do the stories tell us about ourselves? Okay? Break up into little groups. Okay. Who would like to comment on the first part? What did we learn from these stories? What did we learn about the people who lived on this land before Columbus came? In these lands, because these stories are from all of the Americans, from North and South America.
I thought the story showed a more connection with nature, nature being more important.
Uh-huh. Okay. What else?
Not just any nature, but specific places.
Mm-hmm. Specific places?
I saw a yearning for a description of why we were created or what is our purpose. You need to describe that.
A description of our purpose. Okay. Anything else?
And also in some situations a need to say that things were different before. That the situation now had changed from something before, and to include that.
Mm-hmm.
Mine's connected to hers. We talked about this in our group, that's right, but there's not so much seriousness about the present order or reality, there's sort of an imagination and a whimsy, and almost making fun of the current reality. And a number of them anyway, it seemed like they were women's tales because they were making fun of men's domination, saying, well, yeah, I know it's the way it is now, but we always had the power before.
Mm-hmm. What else?
I was struck with how earthy many of the descriptions were, how rooted in natural things. And one of the thoughts that comes to me from that is, I'm not particularly new, but the sense of the sacred as part of everyday life and everyday things rather than separate. Mm-hmm.
Something else you want to? Was there any particular story that you liked or touched you in a certain way?
You don't know the stories.
Okay. I can use my imagination.
You could read them afterwards. Uh-huh. Was there anyone you liked?
The one with the man trying to heal the woman was pretty funny. You know, of course, since she wasn't like him, you know, there was like something must be wrong.
That one flipped me right back to my Western white male psychology.
Uh-huh.
My goodness.
She was sick. Something was wrong with her.
Freud lived in pre-Columbia.
Any other story?
I like the one of the people dancing the egg.
Mm-hmm.
I like the kind of the joy seemed like.
Also seemed like that had to be written by a woman, or not written, had to be a story that took into account the experience of a pregnant woman kicking because of being so eager to be born. I mean, mm-hmm. how many pregnant mothers have you heard say?
Uh-huh.
Whoever this is in here wants out.
Happens to a lot of us, doesn't it?
What else?
I think it makes me wonder who I am.
Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder who you are.
Are there other people who have that feeling?
Where we came from? Where are we rooted? What does it say about us? What do these stories tell us about ourselves?
We are not unique. And we are not in charge.
Something that struck me about having an oral tradition was that the legends and the beliefs and stories are connected to today because they've been told, whereas I think for me it's been written down, and so the book has been passed along and I've been told the stories, but it's come from a place where it was written down so long ago that I wonder how, since the YouTube, how directly connected it is to here. Because it could have been carried along while things changed so much and not been modified because it's printed.
Anything else? What else does it tell us about ourselves today?
We're more analytical than they were. In terms of how we look at things. We would analyze it scientifically. Some stories don't tend to describe, they don't tend to analyze or reason in a Western sense.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I was finding pretty strong that I'm a person of time, mm-hmm. not space or place, and the opposite for these stories. For instance, you know, how long are we going to be here in Holden? Which of us will be long term or short term? How long will we be in the Western United States? How long will you be on your trip? How long is church going to be today? Now where? But, you know, time. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a person of the clock, calendar.
We're tied down to calendars and clocks and agendas and so on. You said something in your group that I thought was interesting about your trip and knowing your, are they your relatives? Mm-hmm. Why don't you share that?
I just got back from Sweden, first time overseas, and looking up relatives, and they were pretty, just around dinner they were asking, so we hear that sometimes the people from the United States, they might move from where they grew up. And this was a serious concern of theirs. Mm-hmm. It was, I thought it was kind of a joke, but they were serious. And I said, well, I've probably moved about 6 times in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And they were just appalled, amazed at that. And just, they could not figure it out. And they said, well, how could you be connected to people in those places if you didn't grow up there? And it's real shocking to say I'm not. And I might find other people traveling through and on the way that I might intersect with again. But for the most part. And I've got cousins that have absolutely no dreams of ever leaving there, ever. And that's perfectly fine with them. And there was something inside me that automatically said there's something wrong with them. And then there was something inside me that kind of cried because I didn't have that. And it's a different, and the rest of my family is rooted in the soil for hundreds and hundreds of years.
And because they're rooted in that soil, they also give great importance to nature and the seasons and what happens to their land and so on, and feel a part of it. One of the stories that I like a lot is the story about corn. Well, for one thing, I lived with those people for a number of years. people of Guatemala wanted to chase. And if we look at the culture of the Maya Quiché and study their sacred writings and know something of their history, we know at the time of the conquest, I prefer to call it that rather than discovery, that at the time of the conquest, there was on these lands of the Americas great civilizations, civilizations that had learned a great deal from the stars, the moon. They have their own calendar, which is more accurate than our calendar, no? And they knew many things and could do many things, and they had many sacred people who, although they had maybe more than one god, I was thinking last week when we were discussing Jeremiah, some of you were there last week, we were talking about the lesser gods. And the Mayans had lesser gods, but they also had great gods, and the goddesses, and the images of mother and earth being mother, all of these things that are so beautiful in the Indian culture, and that in the name of another god, no, that is the same, people came here and conquered the peoples of the Americas. Do we know why people came and conquered the Americas? What were they looking for?
Gold.
Why was Spain, why was the crown of Spain looking for gold?
So they could wage war against other countries and conquer, become bigger, larger, richer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they were trying to expand their empire, weren't they? Mm-hmm. And it was really for more power, for more gold. And I called the attention of those who were in my session the other day, Saturday, some of you were here Saturday, to some of the things I have on the wall there. I really suggest that you take the opportunity to look at this, because I think just as we have these stories, these voices, we also have heard stories and learned things about what happened here, and most of what we learned is not, in most cases, what really happened. And this year, one of the things that people are trying to do in the Americas is to take another look at what this 500 years means. In Spain and in the United States and in different countries, people are celebrating the discovery. And some people in Latin America particularly feel that the real discovery, if you look at the word discover, the people who really discovered were the people who were conquered. They discovered what a cruel and heartless people those people who came to the Americas actually were. And that in the name of God, in the name of religion, they conquered people, they killed people. And I won't go through all of what that says over there, but you can see that there's a difference between discovering and being conquered. And how many people lost their lives in these nations, how the population of the Americas was drastically reduced. Part of it was due to war, part of it was due to diseases for which these people had no antibodies. No, they couldn't resist these diseases. And the other thing was the work to which people were subjected by the conquerors, working in the mines until people's lungs burst. And much of what was written about the early days of conquest was actually written by people like Bartolomé de las Casas, who was a priest. He was actually a rich man who came to the Americas to become richer. And when he got here, he became a priest. He was not a priest before. And what he did was the chronicles of what was actually happening to the people and asking the Spanish crown to treat these people in a different way. One of the references that might be useful to people who are teaching about the discovery and the conquest is this little book called Rethinking Columbus. This was produced by the people
who have an organization that's called Rethinking Schools, Alternative Ways of Education. And I put the address up on the board. There's also an important document in the bookstore, which is a look at different journeys, and one is the journey of Columbus, and it's a biblical analysis of the conquest. What many people in Latin America are saying about this year is that this year should be really a year in which the resistance of the people comes to the forefront. And many people who do not know the Columbus story from the side of those who were oppressed, to learn more about what really has happened. Basically, because one would hope that the same things would not be repeated. But unfortunately, if we look at the history of Latin America, and even the most recent history of Latin America, as I said, I've lived in Central America for the last 25 years, and my experience is one of living in countries where a great deal of repression and oppression takes place. And most of those struggles for national liberation come out of people's desire to be free of that oppression. And where does that oppression come from? It comes from basically this country. This country, the corporations in this country, and the government of this country wanting to maintain the same kind of power that led the Spanish and other colonizers to go to the colonies. They talk about wanting gold and wanting new roots and wanting spices, but what they wanted that for was to fill their treasuries so they could be more powerful. And at the time of the Spanish conquest of the Americas, they took out of the Americas millions and millions of dollars worth of gold and silver, and they filled the treasuries so that though the development after 1492 into the 1500s, the development of Europe really depended upon that gold being taken out of these countries. And that same sort of thing continues today. And we've changed from one conqueror, at the time of the Spanish Empire, to another empire, which is the United States. Now, some people don't like me to say that. I think it's too strong. But if we try to analyze what's really happened, that's the kind of thing that's happening. I can give you very concrete examples. The country of Guatemala is a country where there are favorable conditions for growing bananas. And the United Fruit Company was and continues to be a very important force in Guatemala. And in the 40s, a democratic government was elected in Guatemala. It was elected by the people. It was not as progressive a government as some people would like it to be. It was a government that certainly still continued to be concerned with the welfare of the minority. In this case, mestizo people. It wasn't concerned for the majority, who are the Indian people. But in any case, education was introduced and Indians were no longer regarded as people who had no souls and who had no rights, but they were given their rights. But what happened? The new government of Guatemala in the 40s, up into the 50s, was affecting the business of the United Fruit Company. And so the leaders of the United Fruit Company decided to act upon this, and they, with the help of the U.S. government, to which they were very closely tied, carried out a coup which led to the reinstallation of a military dictatorship in Guatemala. Now, if you analyze who were the people involved in this, they were the Dulleses, John Foster Dulles and his brother Allen Dulles. And some of those names will be familiar to you because they were in the State Department, they were head of the CIA. And what they did is they planned and orchestrated this takeover of a democratically elected government. And they did it all very quietly, very secretively, and called it a justified coup when it was all done with the help of the United States government. And it was done for one purpose. It was done for the United Fruit Company. And
those we kinds call of it American interests. When you read about it in the paper, it won't yes. say United Fruit, it will say American
interests. And I was talking to some young people around here about Coca-Cola and asked them what they thought about Coca-Cola. And people think of Coca-Cola only as being, well, what do you think of, Jenny, when you have a Coca-Cola?
I think of it as a drink, but I'm sure there's more to it that you're going to tell me. Sure.
You think of it as a drink, and what it is, it's really a symbol. It's a symbol of youth and vitality and America and all of that stuff. But what is Coca-Cola? It's a huge corporation. And all around Latin America, Coca-Cola has interests. And in a country that's just right next to Guatemala, it's called Belize, Coca-Cola owns half of the country. Owns half of the country. It's a little tiny country. It used to be British Honduras. It got its freedom from the English, became an independent nation, and rapidly was gobbled up by the Coca-Cola Corporation, because it's a corporation. And what does that mean? Now, on land that could be farmland, that could sustain people, citrus trees are being grown, and the juices are being sent back here to the United States for consumption in the United States, while Belizeans have very little land to grow their crops on, and resort to growing another crop, which is also exported to the United States, which is marijuana. So these kinds of things happen over and over again. And it seems like we never learn the lessons, because the lessons are never really brought home to us. We think of Coca-Cola and we think of life. And I don't know what all the advertisements are now, but I lived in Guatemala at the time that the Coca-Cola Company in Guatemala was forbidding their union to organize, and a good number of labor lawyers and Coca-Cola union leaders were killed in the late 70s and the beginning of the 80s because they were organizing the Coca-Cola workers. So Coca-Cola doesn't mean life to me. It means for many people in Guatemala or in Belize or in other places where the corporation is working, it is a sign of oppression. It is a sign of imperialism. And that imperialism has its headquarters in the United States. This is not to say that all people in the United States are at fault. And I think this is one of the important things that I've learned over the years in working in Central America, is that people in these countries really make a distinction between the people of the United States and the government of the United States. And they blame a lot on the government. But some of us who were in the U.S. Citizens Committee in Nicaragua during the years that the U.S. government supported the Counter-Revolutionary War here felt that, in a way, that's not correct. It's not correct for us to accept that Latin Americans say to us, your government's one thing and your people are another, because they feel that their governments are one thing and they're something else. But supposedly we live in a democracy. And in a democracy, people supposedly elect their officials. Now, I guess if we analyze what happens in the United States, a lot of the officials are elected without popular participation in those elections. When we had our elections in Nicaragua in 1990, that didn't make some of us very happy, when the Sandinistas lost, they did receive about 43% of the vote, but 95 or 96% of the population that could vote voted in that election. No? So the important thing was that people did have that opportunity to vote, and they voted a free and fair election. And the ironic thing about it is that there were thousands, literally thousands of people who came to Nicaragua to observe these elections to make sure that they would be free and fair. No, and there were huge delegations that had to be taken all around the country. No, just think of the cost of that. The poor country that had to take people all around to watch these free and fair elections. And then you look at the elections in the United States, and they may be free, but how fair are they? How fair are they when there's all the abstention that there is? And so I can't accept when a Latin American says to me, your government is one thing and your people are another. I think that if 90% of our people in the United States were voting for a government, then maybe that would be, that would, maybe things would change. But in any case, what most of us working in Latin America and what Latin Americans are saying today about the celebration is that it not be a celebration, but that be a commemoration. And that be a time when people reflect upon history. And history seen from different points of view, and to look at it from the Latin American point of view, and to try to help people realize that what went on long, many years ago, 500 years ago, continues to go on and on and on. And the important thing is to look for ways to stop that imperialism, to stop that, the empire, whether it be the Coca-Cola empire or the United Fruit empire or whatever empire it is, to try to stop that, to work for justice and to work for repentance. And the interesting thing is that the Lutheran Church, as a response to that declaration that's on the wall there, the Declaration of the Indian Peoples of the Americas, that Quito in 1990, was to prepare a resolution at the churchwide assembly in September of 1991, calling this year, 1992, a year of remembrance, repentance, and renewal, and urging people in church groups to discuss and reflect upon what has happened and what continues to happen in the Americas, and to become more conscious of who we are and where we are going. And to see really what can be done, to study, to have observances, but not just that, that's not enough, to bring about some action to change the injustices that exist in our world today. And some of them exist very close at home. Those of you who work with marginal people, poor people, know how much injustice there is and how little is really being done to change that. So that's the challenge I want to leave with you. If you want to read this, I'm also going to put this up on the wall. I'm going to leave these here for the next few days. Tomorrow I'll be having a session in the evening, and it's called Training for Transformation. We're going to do sculpturing. I'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. Okay? I invite you to come back and do some sculpturing. You don't have to be an artist, all right? It's a methodology of grassroots education that I want to share with you. And later on in the week there will be other sessions as well. So, are there any questions before you leave, or any comments you want to make?
I just read a book by Charles Williams. The question, why nothing changes? Because some of us have been saying these things since the 60s. And it doesn't seem to change. And he's pointing toward the demons in the structures, the institutions. And he says that we won't change that. It's sort of like the demons within ourselves. And he connects the inward journey and the outward journey. And he says, look at our own situation personally, and ask the question, have we defeated sin? And we have to ask the same question in when we're doing actions toward justice in the world, because the whole development process has just been a bust. The whole idea of liberation has not happened. And lest we get too disillusioned, I think he thought of another way to look at it. It's mm-hmm. kind of, he was a former head of Christian Aid in Britain.
Uh-huh.
And so he takes a little different stance. It was kind of attractive to me.
Yes.
That we're really doing, we have to take a long-term view and that these empires aren't going to change, because there's always been empires, they've always been demonic. I mean, within the empire, it's always the demonic. And I don't think that leads to not doing anything, but it does give you an interesting perspective.
Well, there are signs of hope every now and then. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're here listening to this. For some reason, something attracted you to come to this session this afternoon. And I think that, those are the ways, that's how things get done. Mm-hmm. The whole world, but we can change. We can change attitudes, we can change people's behavior in the groups that we belong to and are a part of if we want to do that. If everybody would look at, would work at those.
I've heard that a couple times, that the people of Central America jump up and say, no, they're saying democracy. Nowadays, I think these are the elections we should not be looking at, presidential elections, primarily the Congress. But if we've got a choice between someone like a Clinton and a Bush and a Perot, how do you sound in the people? I think they got something going for it. How do you get past that structure of society, from local governments to, maybe the hope comes from what's going on. And I hear a lot of grassroots stuff talking about, we got to get out the vote. But not enough people really doing that, involving that. Mm-hmm.
But there are these little pockets of hope. I mean, look at what's happening in Illinois with Carol Moseley Braun. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one race in which we do have a real choice.
And I think, too, I think you're very right. I think you're very right about there not being as much connection as maybe they would think from outside the country. But compared to a lot of Central American and Latin Americans' experience with the country, ours is very, very much more open. Or, I mean, at least as far as, you know, risking lives to change things, we've got a huge, larger amount of space.
I mean, we can, lots of civil disobedience can take place in this country, and all you have to do is go to jail for it. You don't get killed by the police or a paramilitary group running you down. So it's a different kind. But people have to take risks. Some people risk their lives, others risk going to jail, others don't take any risks at all. The challenge is to take the risk.
It'd be interesting to see in Nicaragua, as say in 10 years when they have an election, if 96% will still vote, because one of the interesting things, I just got back from Switzerland, I was talking to friends, they have low percentage of voters. You know, that's the oldest democracy, right? Straight people participation democracy. And I was reading something about that all the democracies like ours, as they get older, they get less participatory. People seem to just kind of relax and let it run on its own. Which is not good. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens in these newly democratic nations.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.